7 minutes after 11 o'clock, one of those classic debates that don't go out of fashion, but it doesn't mean that it's any less important because it is an old debate, is the debate about the tension sometimes, even in a liberal democracy, between the right to privacy and the legitimate interests of a state to also keep you and me secure. We want as much privacy and freedom more generally as possible. That's what we've signed up for when we designed a society that is based on the dignity of human beings being respected, and part of their dignity often finds expression in what we do in our most private moments. And so you undermine privacy at your peril. You'll remember last year when I had Judge Dennis Davis on the show, and we were talking about that incredible judgment, couple of judgments now that have allowed for the use of marijuana privately to be recognized as a constitutional requirement. And what was beautiful about that judgment, which had started off in the Cape High Court, is that it anchored your right to use marijuana in the first instance in the right to privacy. So privacy is a very important cornerstone of our democracy. And in a country where the world really, we are increasingly transparent because of social media, we really need to make sure that we are precious in our defense of privacy rights. Well, what about particular pieces of legislation then, like the RICA Act that comes along, and it may, on at least one reading of the Act, allow the state to snoop around into our private lives, to keep tabs on us, and to use surveillance to see what journalists are up to, or ordinary citizens for that matter. And that kind of creep on our right to privacy is potentially very dangerous. But how does one balance these competing interests that are both legitimate interests in a democracy? The right to privacy, which you and I are precious about, but at the same time, we'd be mightily pissed off with the state if the state did not keep you and I secure. So what must give when the duty to keep us secure clashes with our right to privacy? That's the conversation we're about to have with Murray Hunter, who's a researcher on surveillance issues, and he joined us now in our Cape Talk studios. Murray, good morning, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Eusebius. Good to be here.
So tell us, the RICA Act, many of us don't know the details. We don't care for it beyond the fact that it often is a little bit of a nuisance when we want to register for a particular piece of technology that we want to use, such as a SIM card, for example. And now there's a case underway. I believe this has been necessitated through some tapping of comms from journalists like Sam Sol, for example. Give us a little bit of a background to it, and then tell us what is, on the face of it, problematic about RICA.
Sure. So everyone, as you say, knows RICA because we've all ostensibly had to register our SIM cards and our internet accounts and that sort of thing. The what's happening in the back room when we do that is that RICA is actually the law that regulates when the state can intercept someone's private communication for, you know, legitimate policing or national security reasons. And what RICA says is that in most cases, in almost all cases, if the state wants to intercept someone's communication, it has to be with the permission of a special judge, and it can only be done for very serious offenses. And what has transpired is that for all of the best intentions that the law might have had, we've seen a growing pile of evidence that the state has, or elements of the state have, abused their surveillance powers. And how this thing ended up in court is that eventually it was proven that state agents were intercepting the phone calls of an investigative journalist, Sam Sol of Ambubungani. And it has created really the scaffolding on which a legal challenge could finally be launched. And so Ambubungani has taken the state to court, saying that RICA has to be unconstitutional for all of the failings that have led, that have enabled the spying of an investigative journalist and potentially many other members of the public as well.
You mentioned an interesting thing when you set that up a minute ago, which is a potential safeguard. We've seen in other countries over the years, as the threat of terror, for example, in places like the USA and the UK, have become worse and worse, or it looks like it. Sometimes it's been worse in history, but with mass media these days, it seems like it's a new phenomenon, be that as it may, that nevertheless, that sometimes your counterparts, civil society activists that want to safeguard liberty in places like the UK, they don't necessarily argue that no surveillance must ever happen, but that there must be due safeguards in place. Is that what is ideal, or should the right to privacy in terms of the state encroaching on it never ever be curtailed?
I don't think that's where we are. I mean, really the argument is acknowledging that there are times when someone's privacy needs to be invaded in order to keep the rest of us safe, in order to prevent a crime from happening. We want is to ensure that when it does happen, it only happens when it's absolutely necessary, when the crime is or the suspected crime is severe enough that it's warranted, and that there is a very high level of safeguard and transparency around it as well. So Amo Bongani's case is really about trying to improve the oversight, improve the transparency, and to close the loopholes for abuse.
So when we take a case like, on his version, what he experienced in terms of Sam Soul, I'm not familiar with the facts. You may help us out to the extent that any of it is in the public realm or in the papers already that have been lodged. I wanted to know, is there a problem with the wording of the RICA Act, or is the abuse that we're talking about abuse that might happen even if we were to have an act that was actually constitutional? Is it the practice, or is it the design of the law that's a problem, or both?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, what Amo Bongani has said in its papers is that half of what they're tackling is what RICA enables, you know, things that RICA says is okay, and half of what it's tackling are things that RICA has been silent on that has created a sort of a space for abuse. But let's talk about the Sam Soul case in particular.
Yeah.
And one of the important things to recognize is that, of course, surveillance is largely a secret abuse. And so it is very difficult for people to pull together information into the public domain to actually understand what's happening. What happened with Sam Soul, you know, the facts that appear to be laid out is that in the late 2000s, when he was reporting on the corruption charges against then former Deputy President Jacob Zuma, members of the National Intelligence Agency, our state security intelligence structure, were tapping his phone, and it appears that they tapped it for at least 6 months. And what they were doing, evidently, was monitoring his calls with confidential sources. Of course, over the course of 6 months, they would have also been intercepting all kinds of private communication he had with his, you know, with his loved ones, and probably calls to the doctor and to, you know, to DSTV and whatever else as well.
Which implicates other rights that he has, doctor,
of course,
patient, you know, confidentiality, and more generally, even if there aren't explicit rights, but things that flow from rights that do exist explicitly, the way in which I conduct my friendships, familial relations, etc., all of those things go into a life that should be protected from observation by Big Brother.
Absolutely, yes. And so one of the first weaknesses that occurs in RICA is that when someone has been targeted for what they call interception, there is, in South African law, there is no provision for that person to ever be informed or find out that they had been spied on. So obviously you wouldn't want someone who's, let's say, a drug smuggler to receive a notification that says the state is monitoring your phone right now, because obviously their behavior would change. But what many advocates are now talking about is what they call post-fact notification. So once your communication has been intercepted, once an investigation against you has concluded, you should receive notification that it has happened. And in fact, many laws, including in very surveillance-happy states like the U.S., many laws do provide that the user is eventually notified. So put it this way, if the police get a search warrant to search your home, you would come home and you would find that your sock drawer was emptied out and your, you know, the lock on your door has been bust and all these other things. You would know that you've been in, you know, that your private space had been searched.
Yeah.
And if you are guilty of a crime, you will face it in court. If you have been wrongly accused or unfairly harassed, you can take legal action against those people for infringing your rights. What happens when your private communication is searched effectively is that it leaves no trace. You are never notified. And so, ironically, the only people who ever find out that they've been spied on are people who are actually eventually charged with a crime and go through criminal proceedings, because you find out, you know, it's introduced as evidence in the court. But people who've been wrongly targeted, and it appears to be journalists, corruption whistleblowers, members of the state who are investigating corruption within their own ranks, these are the people who are typically, you know, seem to be particularly vulnerable for being targeted. And it happens without them ever being able to confirm it, and therefore they can't take steps to protect themselves. So Amo Bungani is saying that there needs to be some level of transparency built into the system so that people who have been targeted find out. It closes the space for abuse. It allows people to act against abusers.
Absolutely. Well, in case you're wondering, where's the other side in this conversation? Is this to one journalist and a free speech, a freedom advocate, as it were, research on surveillance issues, amongst other things, that is just advocating for as much right of journalists to go about their business without being surveilled? Well, the answer is that we did reach out to the state, the attorneys, the lawyers involved, advocates. They weren't interested. They either ignored or turned down the opportunity for a right of reply. So from a journalistic point of view, we certainly went out of our way. So I'm unfortunately left with having to rehearse what arguments they may make. And if I do so imperfectly, blame them for not wanting to come on the show. So to that end, Murray, you know what they're going to say. If we pick up on one or two critical points, right, they will say, okay, sure, we can add the safeguard that Murray is talking about, but here's how it's going to undermine law enforcement. If I, after the fact, tell Murray I was the one snooping around either his cell phone or the one who was responsible for digging around his house, then the modus operandi that I use may give the real criminal that I'm after, say, for example, a potential terrorist, some sort of sign that I am coming for them, and that may undermine the law enforcement agency's work. What do you say to that argument?
Well, again, we are speaking about ensuring that notification happens at the point at which it no longer compromises a legitimate investigation. So one way of doing it would be, and this is how I think it works in the U.S. Wiretap Act, there's a three-month period after which the person would automatically become notified. However, the people who are investigating them can apply to a judge to say, please extend that period by another 3 months, and extend it again by another 3 months if I can show legitimately that informing this person is going to compromise, you know, an actual investigation. You can withhold that notification. But for most people, if they were under suspicion of doing something wrong, they're either charged or they're let go. And at that point, you can actually notify them, by the way, during the course of this investigation, we went through your phone records.
What do you say to someone on Twitter who says, can you please expand the topic? What about the other side of the coin with you journalists? How do you balance the rights of people that you are investigating for journalistic pieces, and you also compromise their privacy? It's a case of tit for tat, this. I'm not sure about that argument, but I thought I'll throw it in there as well. Is there something unique about the business of journalism within which this discussion must be located?
Well, there is. I think first we need to say that obviously journalists do need to balance up the right of the public to know something versus the right of a, you know, an individual to keep certain information about their lives private. Yeah. And they're making that balance every day. And there are means and recourse, of course, to against them when they get that balance wrong. I don't know of any journalist that is able to tap someone's phone that has happened in South Africa, and that would be a very serious infringement, and I think it would be a major scandal. Someone's digital communication, I think, has been recognized as one of the most sensitive and private forms of communication, because it can spell out so much about your private life that you wouldn't be able to see that in most investigative pieces. But why do journalists, why is the privacy of journalists a concern for the rest of us who aren't journalists? Quite simply, we live in a society where, unless you are involved in very serious wrongdoing, you are probably ultimately a beneficiary of a strong investigative media sector. And that media sector, those investigative pieces, are based on the ability of journalists to reach out to sources, to whistleblowers, to speak to them confidentially and get information that we need to know and bring it into the public light. That cannot happen when those whistleblowers and sources can be exposed by the people who are involved in wrongdoing and abuses of power. And really, the privacy of journalists is actually about the privacy of the whistleblowers that they speak to. Of course, it also means...
And that's exactly where I wanted to go next. Yeah. I just want to ask that question explicitly so that we give it a heading. When it comes to the role of sources in investigative journalism, connect some dots for the public, because sometimes the public... Weirdly so, and here I will criticize even my own listeners if they are in this category. They have schadenfreude and think that it's really cool if a journalist gets their comeuppance, if your freedom of you know, media freedoms and your workplace rights as a journalist are being infringed upon. What is the connection, Murray, between being able to do our job, including not disincentivizing sources to speak for us because of this act, and democracy as such?
Well, let's look at what a whistleblower is. Now, there are many people who might speak to a journalist, but let's speak specifically about whistleblowers. These are often people who are not public figures. They might work for the private sector. They may work for government, wherever there's abuse of power.
Yeah.
A whistleblower is a person who sees something wrong, and as a matter of their conscience, they need that information to become public. The public has a right to know. These are, in reality, many cases, very vulnerable people. They might be an accountant. They might be work a desk job. They may be a legal advisor to someone in power. They are people who, if their identity were known as the source of that damaging information, they face tremendous consequences, legal, financial, personal. Sometimes it's a matter of their physical safety. Their ability to speak confidentially to a journalist is really the thing that is enabling that information about wrongdoing coming into our hands as the public.
Mm.
And that means that so if we look at any single corruption scandal that matters to a member of the public,
yeah,
you can almost be guaranteed that there was someone who was
absolutely
on that side of the equation who was able to reach out to a journalist to say, this is something people need to know.
So in other words, if we keep it practically, a key part of the accountability of thugs, such as, for example, the Gupta email leaks, it is less likely that kind of gem may find its way into the hands of a journalist if we do not have the RICA Act being properly governed.
That's exactly right.
And so the public may think that journalists are simply trying to be cheeky, but actually your own ability to make an informed decision in terms of your political rights as a citizen could be at stake if journalists are unable to do journalism properly.
Absolutely. But we need to remember as well that the Ambo Bongani case is not only about the privacy of journalists. What they're saying is that there needs to be a change in the rules that protects everyone. And they're saying, obviously, there are certain people who have particularly a professional need for communication.
Yeah.
And that might be a lawyer. It might be a journalist. It may be a priest who receives confessions. There are certain people whose professional conduct requires them to keep other people's privacy safe.
Mm.
But actually, this is really about protecting every single person's privacy against unwarranted abuse.
Yeah, because there are variations on this thing. I've highlighted journalism, but as you say, I mean, the priest example is interesting. But also, let's take politics, right? I mean, you can, if you have your levers on power inside the intelligence clusters, you can potentially spy, for example, on political opponents. That's also not good for society. So there are reverberations way beyond journalism as a field.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the places where surveillance has been documented as happening is actually against police officers themselves who are investigating colleagues for possible corruption. The means of surveillance, the powers of surveillance are used by corrupt cops or members of agencies in order to strategize against investigations that they face.
Mm.
And so as much as it sometimes seems that, this might be, that we're all banging on against government agents, this is actually about ensuring that everyone is protected to be able to do their job.
In that regard, let's situate this conversation in the 3-4 minutes that's left inside that exceptionally important review that many of us, because the news cycle comes and goes so quickly, have almost forgotten about. The review of the State Security Agency was critical because, in a sense, if you're not an expert, you might think intuitively, Murray, that there needs to be a certain amount of opacity when it comes to how the spooks operate, whether we talk about budgets, slush funds, etc., that it's the price we need to pay as Democrats in order to live in a safe society. We now know that is false, and that if there is too much opacity in how the spooks are behaving, that society can actually have the constitutional democratic project subverted. And that's quite apart from the blatant corruption and stealing of money that can happen because of a lack of accountability.
Absolutely. I think that we all agree that there needs to be a balance between transparency and you know, protecting confidential information. We do see that that balance is completely off at the moment, and it's in that secrecy that abuses of power have really thrived, and it's time to actually to move the shadow lines further to the edges of public life.
Last question, what should be the role of the judiciary in this? Should there be, because I see one practical difficulty with even getting a judicial officer to sign off on permission to go and snoop around and to make their judgment call whether or not a particular intelligence operative has got the right kind of reasonable suspicion to want to tap your phone or my communications, for example. But precisely because they live in the shadows, if they don't volunteer through a new culture of openness and being law-abiding to actually seek that kind of approval beforehand, then it will be business as usual. So what is the long-term project here in terms of getting the entire intelligence cluster inside of the criminal justice system to be able to play by rules that they've never been used to playing before 1994, and we now know apparently not after 1994 either?
Of course, there's a role for the judiciary, and they will say that judges are already forced to authorize these things. What we are saying is that judicial function needs to be better funded. We need better supported judges making decisions with more information, more time. There needs to be more judges. But actually, I think that the long-term project is not in changing the rules. It's not in boosting the judiciary. It's a political project about ensuring that the right to privacy is at the center of the public imagination as something crucial to securing our democracy, to ensuring that people have dignity, that people are respected and able to work in the society productively and enjoy their rights. So this is actually about ensuring that once the public is able to put the proper price on protecting their privacy, those abuses will become too politically costly for any government to actually try to get away with them.
Beautifully put. Got nothing more to add. Murray, love your work. Thanks for your consistency in this area. Really appreciate it. And thanks for coming on the show.
And thank you to the ministers for listening in.
Touché. That was Murray Hunter, researcher on surveillance issues, previously with the Right to Know campaign.